This lecture, entitled Neshama, Life After Death and the Resurrection of the Dead, is dedicated to the memory of Le'ilui Nishmas Moshe Elozer ben Mordechai Olav HaSholom, Mr. Morris Goldenberg, of blessed memory. Suspend your disbelief for a moment and imagine, if you will, you're taking a long and pleasant walk in the countryside. And as you're walking, absorbed in your thoughts, out of the corner of your eye, you spy an odd-looking object lying on the side of the road. You stop to take a better look, and to your surprise, you realize that the object looks exactly like one of those ancient lamps, something out of 1001 Arabian Nights, just like the one that Aladdin is supposed to have discovered. Out of sheer curiosity, you walk over to it, pick it up, try to take off the cover. And as you're moving and rubbing it, all of a sudden, to your utter amazement, there emerges from the lamp an enormous genie, a spirit in the form of a man, and he begins to talk to you. He tells you he's been trapped in the lamp for over 1,000 years, and no words can express how indebted he feels to you. He also tells you, however, that he has to immediately take leave of you, as over 1,000 years have already passed, and he has much unfinished business to attend to. But before he leaves, as a token of his appreciation, he offers to answer any burning question you might have about life. After all, as a genie, he has special insight and knowledge that humans lack. But he makes it clear to you that he's in a big rush, so please, only one short question. Think about it. What would that question be? One question is bothering you that no one has the answer. If you'd be in the situation I just described, I'm not sure what your question would be. But to me, probably one of the most important and burning questions that any person should ask, if he hasn't asked the question already, is what happens to us when we die? You all know that according to religious belief, a belief shared by virtually every religious system, the human personality, your consciousness, the real you, not your hands, face, legs, but your real self, is spiritual and not merely physical. It survives bodily death and continues to function outside of the body. Ultimately, the spirit or consciousness is judged. And what happens to it afterwards is based upon the kind of life that the person has lived here. In other words, the fate of a Hitler is different than that of a Moses, of Moshe Rabbeinu. Of course, each religious system differs in the details, but the picture on the whole is very similar. According to this view, bodily death is merely a change in venue for the consciousness and not cause for its extinction. The only real fear of death is the fear that we'll have to face judgment for our actions, something perhaps we should all keep in mind as we reevaluate the choices we constantly make or have made for ourselves in the past. This, of course, is a very different picture than the current materialistic, body-focused understanding of the personality and consciousness that's in vogue, you know, today. And according to that view, your consciousness is the product of the chemical and electrical activity of your brain. Upon death, once the brain ceases to function, the personality, the consciousness, the real you, is gone forever. Life, then, is very short, perhaps too short. But whatever kind of a person you are, according to this view, saint or sinner, Hitler or Moses, in the final analysis, it doesn't make a big difference. The end is all the same. To some, this materialistic view is very comforting. You can do whatever you want in life, and there's no accountability. In fact, as we find in the writings of Epicurus, the 3rd century BCE Greek philosopher who developed this doctrine, freedom without accountability is the main appeal of this view. As you well know, the secular view has become very much the mainstream view, especially among secularly educated Jews. In a 1952 Gallup poll, when asked if they believe in life after death, over 3 out of every 4 Americans responded that they definitely believed in life after death. Only 1 out of 3 Jews said that they share that belief. By 1965, 3 out of every 4 Americans still responded they definitely believed in life after death. However, by that time, less than 1 out of every 5 Jews said they shared that belief. It would seem that over time, the Jewish community has increasingly assimilated this secular view. We're saying the secular view that man is really just his body. This attitude has had far-reaching results for the Jewish community. But think about it. If there's no life after death, it really doesn't make much of a difference what kind of a life you lead. Moral, immoral, Jewish, non-Jewish. What counts is that you're happy. There's nothing to worry about. There's no fear that you'll be judged for living the wrong kind of life. No wonder, then, that according to current trends, something like 85% of the Jewish community is on the brink of extinction. Is their children and grandchildren, who harbor similar materialistic beliefs, no longer feel any compelling need to identify as Jews, marry other Jews, bring into the world Jewish children, and raise them as Jews. The people that gave the Jews, the people that gave the world the Torah, the belief in one God, an all-encompassing spiritual, moral, and ethical way of life. So getting back to our genie, this question, what happens to us when we die, is probably one of the most important questions that you could ask. Of course, the truth is, we don't have a genie and can't ask him for the answer. But the answer does exist. Despite the refrain, nobody has come back to tell us, the answer is widely available, not just from religious sources, but from carefully researched studies into the evidence of life after death. People have come back, not some, but thousands and perhaps millions. I'm now going to quote from some of these studies, but you owe yourself to go to the library, the bookstore, and continue the research on your own. In the year 1974, a relatively thin book established by a minor publisher took the world by storm and became an international bestseller. The book, Life After Life, by Dr. Raymond Moody, brought together the stories of some 100 people who claimed that at the time they were near the brink of death, their consciousness left their bodies. Many of them claimed that their consciousness was actually above their bodies, and they were aware of all that was happening to them in the room, even though they were clinically dead and showed no outward signs of life. Many of them even claimed that they left this world and came to the spirit world, a world filled with life and peace, light and peace, and they often described it in great detail. One of the most astounding things was that despite their different religious, cultural, and educational backgrounds, they told a very similar story. After the publication of that book, many doctors, primarily cardiologists, who deal with patients whose hearts stopped, were revived. Says the patients' hearts stopped and were subsequently revived, confirmed this phenomenon, which is today known as the near-death experience. I would like to take this opportunity to share with you some of their stories, as to better acquaint you with this phenomenon. You owe it to yourself, however, not to be satisfied with my small sampling, but to do further research into the subject. And as I said before, it is widely available in libraries and the bookstores. As we just said, very often the person who goes through this experience describes themselves as leaving their bodies and hovering overhead. Some even give us a description of their newfound spiritual body. The following citations come from the book Life After Life by Dr. Raymond Moody. This is on page 36. Quote, And these are interviews of people who claimed that they had this near-death experience. When I came out of the physical body, it was like I did come out of my body and go into something else. I didn't think I was just nothing. It was another body, it continues on, but not another regular body. It's a little bit different. It wasn't exactly like a human body, but it wasn't any big glob of matter either. It had form to it, but no colors. And I know I still had something you could call hands. I can't describe it. I was more fascinated with everything around me, seeing my own body there. In other words, this person claimed that their consciousness, so the spirit, left their physical body, and they were hovering over the body, so they were looking down. Seeing my body there and all. So I didn't think about the type of body I was in. And all this seemed to go so quickly. Time wasn't really an element, and yet it was. Things seem to go faster after you get out of your body. End quote. Another person described it in the following manner. Quote, I remember being wheeled into the operating room, and the next few hours were the critical period. During that time, I kept getting in and out of my physical body, and I could see it from directly above. But while I did, I was still in a body, not a physical body, but something I could best describe as an energy pattern, if I had to put it into words. I would say that it was transparent, a spiritual as opposed to a material being, yet it definitely had different parts, end quote. What is amazing is that these people have vivid memories of their experience, experiences that occurred outside their bodies, when the brain couldn't have processed the information and stimuli, the information and stimuli that they were receiving. Evidently, this spiritual body has its own memory, which perhaps when it returns to the body later interfaces with the brain. How vivid are their memories? Let me quote to you from another book by a cardiologist. It's At Death's Door by Dr. Maurice Rawlings, whose findings changed his own life. The following is taken from pages 73 to 75. And I'm quoting now. Some of my patients have demonstrated astounding powers of recall, accurately reconstructing the events that occurred during the resuscitation, exactly recalling which procedures we used, and describing what each person said in the room and what type of color of clothes each one wore. Several other visualized events suggest a spiritual existence outside the body during the time of prolonged unconsciousness. Such states of coma sometimes last several days. One such patient was a nurse. At the hospital one day, I was asked to see her in consultation about her heart because of complaints of recurrent chest pains. She was not in her room, but a roommate said that she was either in the x-ray department or was still in the bathroom. I knocked on the bathroom door. Hearing no response, I swung the door open very slowly, hoping not to embarrass anyone who might be there. As the door swung open, there was the nurse hanging from the coat hook on the back of the bathroom door. She was not very large, and so she swung easily with the opening door, suspended from the coat hook by a soft collar used for neck sprains. Apparently, she had attached the collar around her neck and then fastened the edge of it over the hook, gradually bending her knees until unconsciousness occurred. No suffocation or choking, just a gradual fainting. There's evidence she was attempting suicide. The more the faintness occurred, the more she slumped. At death, her face, tongue, and eyes were bulging and swollen. Her face had a dark bluish tinge. The rest of her body had a death pallor. She had long since stopped breathing. I quickly unhooked her and laid her full length on the floor. Her pupils were dilated. There was no pulse in her neck, and no heartbeat could be heard with my ear to the chest. I started external heart resuscitation while her roommate ran down the hall to get help from the nursing staff. Oxygen and a breathing mask were substituted for mouth-to-mouth ventilation. The electrocardiogram showed straight line, standstill. No electric shock would have helped. Intravenous sodium bicarbonate and epinephrine were given directly in repeated doses while other drugs were added to the intravenous bottle. Continuous drip infusion of medications were given to support the blood pressure and help correct the shock. She was then taken to the intensive care unit by a stretcher, where she remained in a coma for 4 days. Because of the dilated pupils, it appeared that brain damage had occurred from inadequate circulation during the period of heart arrest. Surprisingly, though, after a few hours, her blood pressure started returning to normal. The urine output increased as adequate circulation of blood was restored. It was several days before she was able to speak. She eventually regained all of her faculties and returned to work several months later. To this day, she believes she had been in some sort of automobile accident that caused her neck to be sore for so long. Whereas she entered the hospital with severe depression, she has now recovered with no residual depression or suicidal tendency, apparently cured by the prolonged period when the brain had no blood supply. Don't try it. About the second day after recovery from her coma, I asked her if she remembered anything at all. She said, quote, "Oh, I remember you were working on me. You took off your plaid brown coat and threw it on the floor. And then you loosened your tie. I also remember your tie had a white and brown stripes on it. The nurse who came to help you looked so worried. I tried to tell her I was all right. You told her to get an AmpuBag and also an Intracath to start an IV. Then two men came in with a stretcher. I remember all of that," end quote. Recall with me, this is again Dr. Rawlings, she was in a deep coma that particular time and remained in a coma another 4 days. At that time, I took off my brown plaid coat. Only she and I were in the room, and she was clinically dead. End quote. That's the end of that passage. This is just one of thousands of examples. And they're not limited just to the room where the body is laying. In a subsequent book entitled The Light Beyond, Dr. Moody tells the story of a woman who he calls June. And this June was very sick. She was being operated on. And she claimed that during the operation, her consciousness left the body. And she was hovering over her body, watching the operation, and she claimed she was bored. You know, after a while, you know, there's nothing doing. So she decided to leave the room and to travel a little bit. And she went across the hall in what was the waiting room for the family. And she saw her brother-in-law there. And the brother-in-law happened to bump into an old friend. And she says over the conversation that the friend saw the brother-in-law and says, "Hey, what are you doing here?" And he says, "You know, it looks like my sister-in-law June is going to," and he says, quote, "kick the bucket. And I had to cancel my business trip because it looks like I'm going to be one of the pallbearers." Evidently, she heard enough, this June, and went back to the operating room. The operation was a success, and when she gained consciousness, was able to receive visitors, her brother-in-law came to visit her. And the first words out of June's mouth was, "You know, next time you plan a trip, just go right ahead. I'll be just fine." And it looked like he was going to have a near-death experience. Yeah. As I said before, many of them describe themselves as having gone to the spirit world, to heaven. How do these people describe it? Let me quote you from Dr. Moody's book, Reflections on Life After Life, which he published in 1975. This is the year after Life After Life. There was a sequel. This begins on the bottom of page 16 of that book. Quote, "I was at the head of the bed looking at them and my body." And again, he's describing that the consciousness had left the body. "At one time, one nurse reached up to the wall over the bed to get the oxygen mask that was there. And as she did, she reached through my neck. And after I floated up, I went through this dark tunnel and came out into a brilliant light. I'm skipping. A little bit later on, I was there with my grandparents and my father and my brother who had died. It's interesting, the Zohar also describes a similar phenomenon. It continues on, there was the most beautiful, brilliant light all around, and this was a beautiful place. There were colors, bright colors, not like here on Earth, but just indescribable. There were people there, happy people, and it continues on. People were around, some of them gathered in groups. Some of them were learning. And it continues on, off in the distance I could see a city. There were buildings, separate buildings that were gleaming bright. People were happy in there. There were sparkling water, fountains, a city of light. I guess that would be the best way to say it. Continues on. It was wonderful. There was beautiful music. Everything was just glowing wonderful. And it continues, but if I had entered into this, like going to a place, I think I would never have returned. I was told that if I went there, I couldn't go back. And that the decision was mine. End quote. What is truly amazing is the similarity of these visions in the many studies. You know, one person has a hallucination, Einzach. Generally, people don't hallucinate the same things. But although the description seems to be very reassuring and very positive, there are indications there really is really much more to the afterlife experience than what is described by those people who really didn't die, but only had a taste of the afterlife for a very short time. You know, just before we quote again from one of the studies, it just reminds me of a very cute joke. It was told that 3 weeks before David Ben-Gurion passed away, he had a dream. And in his dream, he saw that he died. And he went to the Beis Din Shamayla, as he went to the divine tribunal. And they told him that since he had led the Jewish people, he'll be granted a special privilege that very few people are granted. He himself can choose whether he wants to go to heaven or to hell. So whatever you say about Ben Gurion, it's been a kluger yid. He says, show me. What's heaven? What's the other place? So first they showed him heaven. It was one big Beis Medrash. He said, okay, I saw enough. Show me the other place. So one big issue. So they showed him, they took him, and it was wonderful. It was lush. It was beautiful. It was music. People were happy. This was the other place. And with that, he woke up. 3 weeks to the day, Ben-Gurion died. And the events unfolded just like in the dream. He was taken to the Beis Din Shamayla, to the divine tribunal. He was told this speech that since he was a leader of the Jewish people, he'd be granted a special privilege. He himself could decide whether he wants to go to heaven or hell. And this time there was no hesitation. I want to go to the other place. And with that, he was escorted down to the other place. And it was hot and it was burning and people were screaming. It was terrible. And he looks to the angel guide who escorted him down there. And he said, hey, wait a minute. This isn't what they showed me. And the angel says, that's what they show the tourists. Okay, now let's go back to the... The following is taken again from Dr. Rawlings' book, Beyond Death's Door, starting from page 17. Yeah, and now I'm quoting Dr. Rawlings. The following is a description of what happened to a patient of his, who was in the midst of taking a stress test on a treadmill while being connected to an EKG, an electrocardiogram machine. Quote, This patient was a 48-year-old white male who was a rural mail carrier. He was of medium build, dark-haired, and had a personality that would please anyone. Unfortunately, he represented one of those rare instances where the EKG not only went haywire, but the heart stopped altogether. Like this in the midst of the stress test. He had a cardiac arrest and dropped dead right in my office. Instead of fibrillating, like twitching without a beat, the heart had just plain stopped. He crumpled to the floor, lifeless. With my ear to his chest, I could hear no heartbeat at all. With my hand alongside his Adam's apple, I could feel no pulse. He gave one or two sighing breaths before he quit breathing altogether. There were scattered muscle twitchings and then convulsions. He was gradually turning blue. Although six other doctors work as partners in the same clinic, it was late afternoon and they had gone on to other hospitals to make evening rounds. Only the nurses were left. But they knew what to do and their performance was commendable. While I started external heart massage by pushing in and out in on his chest, one nurse initiated mouth-to-mouth breathing. Another nurse found a breathing mask, which made it easier to expand his lungs for him. Still, another nurse brought the emergency cart containing pacemaker equipment. Unfortunately, the heart would not maintain its own beat. A complete heart block had occurred. The pacemaker was needed to overcome the block and increase the heart rate from 35 beats per minute to 80 or 100 per minute. I had to insert a pacemaker wire into the large vein beneath the collarbone, which leads directly to the heart. One end of this electric wire was manipulated through the venous system and left dangling inside the heart. The other end was attached to a small battery-powered gadget that regulates the heartbeat and overcomes the heart block. The patient began, quote-unquote, coming to. But whenever I would reach for instruments or otherwise interrupt my compression of his chest, the patient would again lose consciousness, roll his eyes upwards, arch his back in mild convulsions, stop breathing, and die once more. Each time he regained heartbeat and respiration, the patient screamed, "I'm in hell!" He was terrified and pleaded with me to help him. I was scared to death. In fact, this episode literally scared the hell out of me. It terrified me enough to write this book. He then issued a very strange plea. Don't stop! You see, the first thing most patients I resuscitate tell me as soon as they recover consciousness is, "Take your hands off my chest, you're hurting me." I'm big, and my method of external heart massage sometimes fractures ribs. But this patient was telling me, "Don't stop!" Then I noticed a genuinely alarmed look on his face. He had a terrified look, worse than the expression seen in death. The patient had a grotesque grimace expressing sheer horror. His pupils were dilated and he was perspiring, trembling. He looked as if his hair was on end. Then still another strange thing happened. He said, "Don't you understand, man? I'm in hell. Each time you quit, I go back to hell. Don't let me go back to hell." Being accustomed to patients under this kind of emotional stress, I dismissed this complaint and told him to keep his quote-unquote hell to himself. I remember telling him, "I'm busy, don't bother me about your hell until I finish getting this pacemaker into place." But the man was serious and finally occurred to me that he was indeed in trouble. He was in a panic like I'd never seen before. As a result, I started working feverishly and rapidly. By this time, the patient experienced three or four episodes of complete unconsciousness and clinical death from the cessation of both heartbeat and breathing. After several death episodes, he finally asked me, "How do I stay out of hell?" I told him, I guess it was the same principle learned in Sunday school, that I guess God would be the one whom you would ask to save you. Then he said, "I don't know how, pray for me." Pray for him? What nerve? I told him I was a doctor, not a preacher. "Pray for me," he repeated. I knew I had no choice. It was a dying man's request. So I had him repeat the words after me as he worked right there on the floor. It was a very simple prayer because I did not know much about praying. It went something like this. Lord, I ask you to keep me out of hell. Forgive my sins. I turn my life over to you. If I die, I want to go to heaven. If I live, I'll be on the quote-unquote on the hook forever. The patient's condition finally stabilized, and he was transported to a hospital. I went home, dusted off the Bible, and started reading it. I had to find exactly what hell was supposed to be like. I'd always dealt with death as a routine occurrence in my medical practice, regarding it as an extinction with no need for remorse or apprehension. Now I was convinced there was something about this life after death business after all. All of my concepts needed revision. I needed to move to find out more. It was like finding another piece in a puzzle that supports the truth of the scriptures. I was discovering that the Bible was not merely a history book. Every word was turning out to be true. I decided I'd better start reading it very closely. A couple of days later, I approached my patient with pad and pencil in hand for an interview. At his bedside, I asked him to recall what actually he saw in hell. Were there any flames? Did the devil have a pitchfork? What did hell look like? He said, "What hell? I don't recall any hell." I recounted all of the details he had described 2 days earlier while he was on the floor next to a treadmill machine being resuscitated. He could recall none of the unpleasant events. Apparently, the experience was so frightening, so horrible, so painful, that his conscious mind could not cope with them, and they were subsequently suppressed far into his subconscious. The man, by the way, has stayed, quote-unquote, on the hook. He continues on, he does, however, remember the prayer we said, and he remembers passing out once or twice after that. He still does not recall the experience that occurred in hell, but he does recall standing in the back of the room and watching us work on his body there on the floor. He also recalls meeting both his mother and stepmother during one of these subsequent death episodes. The meeting place was on a gorge full of beautiful colors. He also saw other relatives who had died before. This experience was very pleasurable, occurring in a narrow valley with very lush vegetation and brilliant illumination by a huge beam of light. He quote-unquote saw his mother for the first time. She had died at age 21 when he was 15 months old, and his father had soon remarried. This man had never even seen a picture of his real mother. And yet he was able to pick her picture out of several others a few weeks later when his mother's sister, after hearing of his experience, produced some family pictures for identification. There was no mistake, the same auburn hair, the same eyes and mouth, the face was identical to the lady he saw in his experience. She was still 21 years old. There was no doubt it was his mother. He was astounded, and so was his father. End quote. At this point, I'd like to interject that on the whole, what this man remembered is very similar to thousands of other such cases. Seeing dead relatives, even identifying pictures of some that they had never seen in real life. The description of heaven is very similar to many other cases, including the one we quoted before. The experience of hell, though, is not typical. If it is true as the other very similar aspects of the near-death experiences, why don't these people recall this as well? We read together Dr. Rawlings' theory that the unpleasant experience is not retained in the conscious memory, it becomes submerged into the subconscious. Dr. Rawlings further theorizes, quote, similar circumstances might explain the paradox of finding only good cases reported in the literature thus far. When patient interviews are delayed in any way, this may allow enough time for the good experience to be mentally retained and reported by the patient and the bad experience to be rejected or obliterated from recall. End quote. Again, all that I quoted was for the purpose of giving you a small taste of an enormous literature. You owe it to yourselves to do further research. As we said before, ultimately, it is this belief in the spiritual nature of man, the afterlife, and the judgment that colors and informs all of our actions. In the words of Dag Hammarskjöld, who is the second Secretary General of the United Nations, quote, No choice is uninfluenced by the way in which the personality regards its destiny and the body its death. In the last analysis, it is our conception of death which decides our answers to all the questions that life puts to us. Hence, too, the necessity of preparing for it, end quote. At this point, you're probably wondering, what does traditional Judaism, what does the Torah have to say about all of this? First of all, as in virtually all traditional religions, Judaism places enormous emphasis on the afterlife and the ultimate judgment. The following is only a small sampling here on your handouts. On page 1, here we begin, we quote here, famous quote, this is Rabbi Yaakov Omer, Olam Hazeh Domer Leprozdor B'fnei Olam Habo. Yaakov said this world is a lobby before the world to come. Haskin Atzmecho B'froizdor. Prepare yourself in the lobby, Keshitikones Letraklin, so you may enter the banquet hall. And in paragraph B, we quote the famous aphorism from Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva used to say, know that everything is according to the reckoning. And let not your evil inclination promise you the grave will be an escape for you. For against your will you were created, against your will you were born, against your will you will live, against your will you die, and against your will you are destined to give an account before the King who rules over kings, the Holy One, blessed be He. It's amazing that amongst non-Orthodox Jews, not only is this belief not taught, but for the most part, they're not even aware that Jews have traditionally lived their lives based on this belief. You know, the Jewish belief has always recognizes that there's a Gan Eden, there's a heaven, there's Gehenim, there's hell, or purgatory. The fate of Hitler is different from that of Moses. But for, I guess, probably the majority of non-Orthodox Jews, they believe that that's a Christian belief, not a Jewish belief. And but the founders of Christianity did not create these ideas or borrow them from pagans, but merely took their beliefs with which they grew up as Jews and incorporated them into the nascent church. One reason, however, there's so much ignorance about the subject is that first and foremost, the Torah is a way of life. Living a godly life, improving ourselves and the world about us, is the major focus of Judaism. And the backdrop, the idea of an afterlife, an ultimate judgment, is often taken for granted and therefore is generally not emphasized. But it's this focus of spirituality and good deeds, though, which defines Judaism. Like the importance of doing, that we're not waiting to die. You know, there's a church hymn about waiting for paradise. We're not waiting. Here on paragraph C, we quote again from Ovis. This is also from Rabbi Yaakov. He used to say, better 1 hour spent in repentance and good deeds in this world, Yofashachas b'tshuva ma'isim tovim b'olam hazeh mekol chayolam haba, says then the entire life of the world to come. We're given the opportunity to do, we have to take that opportunity. And really it's because of that, very often, that there's not a focus about the afterlife. But of course it really informs everything that we do. It's important also to know, when we speak about Torah, you know, from a traditional viewpoint, there are really two Torahs. You know, there's the Torah Shebiktav and the Torah Shebaal Peh. You know, there's the written law. This is makes up the books of the Bible. And says, and there's the oral law, which makes up the Talmud, the Medrash, the Kabbalah. And because of the subtle nature of the soul in spirituality, the teachings of the afterlife are, for the most part, contained in the Torah Shebaal Peh, in the oral law. It's really not in the written law. So a person who reads through, you know, the Bible, there's very little of it. But it is nonetheless hinted at, even though
it's not a major focus. For instance, here on the bottom of the first page, it says, and it says, V'yigva v'yomas Avrom v'seva toiva zoken v'soveya v'yosef el amov, that Abraham gave up his spirit and died in a good old age, old man full of years, and was gathered to his people. And his sons, Yitzchak and Yishmael, buried him. There is a idea of death, gather to his people, and burial. Evidently, gather to people is distinct from burial. Gather to people means that the consciousness came together with the previous generations. We have here again, we quote just briefly on the top of page 2. This is the story with Shmuel Hanovi and Shaul HaMelech. King Saul, this is right before his death, was about to wage war against the Philistines who had gathered an army against him. And he was frightened. He wanted some direction. Shmuel HaNovi had died. And he went to a Balas Ov. He went to a medium, a woman who conjures up spirits. He wanted to speak to the spirit of Shmuel HaNovi. And it describes this in the first book of Samuel, it's chapter 28, describes how he spoke to him. And this is in Shmuel said to Shaul, why have you disturbed me to bring me up? And then Saul explained, I'm sorely distressed, for the Philistines are waging war against me, and God has departed from me, and doesn't answer me any longer, neither by the prophets nor by the dreams. I've called unto you, so you should tell me what I should do. And he told him that he was going to die in battle the next day. But it's evident that the belief of the, was part of their life. The reason it's not stressed is for various reasons, but one of them is it's part of the oral tradition. When we speak about the soul and the spirit, we really there are certain words, very often they're interchangeable, but in a strict sense they mean different things. There is the neshama. You know, v'yipach bi'ap of nishmas chayim. God breathed the breath of life into the nostrils of man, of Adam. There's ruach, spirit. Here we have in Kohelis, in Ecclesiastes, the Yoshev Ofer says al oretz, and the dust returns to the earth, and this man returns to the earth. And the spirit says v'aruach toshev elokim, the spirit returns unto God who gave it. There's the idea of spirit. And of course, there's nefesh, the life force. I'll surely regard the spilling of your blood which forms your life force will require the justice be meted out. And he explains that really they are distinct entities. And it seems that nefesh is the life force of every cell. That's life. Ruach, spirit, seems to be our consciousness. You know, when we said the near-death experience, the person left his body and he had another body. It seems that's the ruach. The neshama is really the special link between man and God. And it seems it's not really you. Like, it's God's connection to you. And we just quote here, the quote is, it's widely, this is widely quoted, it's just, we quote here from the Tanya, we have two quotes, but it's really the sources are universal. I mean, it's just, this is one of many quotes, we're going to quote the Malbim soon, about the different, he speaks about in great detail about the different life forces. And he speaks about what this neshama is. The second soul of the Jew is part of God above. As written, he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. And you breathe into me, and is written in the Zohar, he who exhales from within him. When you breathe from within you. As the breath comes from deep within you. That's metaphorically, it's something from within God himself. Metaphorically. So on one hand we have this close connection, on the other, as the Tanya points out, as we say, you know, we say the bracha Elokai neshama shenasatibi, which we're going to touch upon, soon finish. So the soul which you breathe into, the soul is not me. There's me, and there's a soul that you breathed into me. And as he says, with regard to the divine soul here on top of page 3, within him it is said, as we said, that the soul you have given within me is pure. The words which you gave within me clearly imply that man himself is not the pure soul. That's because the man pushes the ruach. That's his spirit. The opposite of the case with tzaddikim. With them, the pure soul, which is the divine soul, is the man himself. In other words, it merges together. Their body is called the flesh of man, secondary to the real man, the divine soul. According to them, then it's really the you really become part of the divine itself. The Malbim explains it in the following manner here. This is in Parshas Chukas. He says, the divine soul, neshama, which comes to a person from on high, of which there's a specific mention in the verse, he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, has no integral bond with the physical body. When the person dies, it is not damaged in any way, but rather merely separates from him and returns to its source, the bond of life. The amorphous spirit, and this is the ruach, which is referred to as ruach, which is born together with the body and can undergo a radical change through the person's actions, which change it into a spiritual entity, is connected to the body in a firm bond, for it is born of the physical world. In other words, we come to this world with the ruach. Our job is somehow merge this into the neshama, and to make that change. We make that change through our mitzvahs, through our study, but it's really to transform ourselves. So this is the ruach. So I'd like to briefly just go over now this, the tefillah, the prayer that we have, that we touch on as soon as we get up in the morning. Shortly afterwards, we wash our hands, and we make this bracha. It says, Lokai neshama shenasatibi. And again, we start off, you know, with the idea that first of all, that we start off that he is called Elokai, my God. The word we find Elohim, the spiritual, and we find Elohim, the secular, for judge. Judges, as we quote here on top of verse 4, is Elohim. So the spiritual Elohim is really the divine judge. So we start off basically calling God, referring to him as you are my judge. This is the first words that comes from us. And it starts, then we continue on. This is Neshama Shinasati Bitairahi, which we said before. It's a pure spirit. The soul is pure. It's interesting here on page 4. There's a wonderful quote here. This is taken from the Gemara Nida in 30b, about the importance for us to remember it's pure. Reb Simloy delivered the following discourse. He says, this is about how when a child is born. It does not emerge from there before it is made to take an oath. Before we are born, we take an oath. What is the nature of the oath that is made to take? That's, we are told, be a tzaddik, a righteous person, and do not be a rasha, a wicked person. And even the entire world tells you you're a tzaddik, regard yourself as a rasha. Or at least potential. You know, Altama be'atzmacha ad yom mo'ischa. Can't trust in yourself the day you die. Always bear in mind that the Holy One, blessed be He, is pure, that His ministers are pure. This is all part of the oath. And that the soul which He gave you is pure. If you preserve it in purity, well and good, but if not, I will take it away from you. In other words, guard it. So really, that's that idea. We wake up in the morning, first of all, we have the idea we're accountable to God. That's one of the first things that come out from our mouth. Elokai, you're my judge. And second of all, we say the relationship of our soul. It says you gave it's pure, and there's an implication that we have to maintain its purity. And again, we said, it's something that you created. It says, This is taken from the Gemara. There are different nuskoyas. He says, you formed it and you breathed it into me, which is a reference to the fact of the creation of man. It really goes, and the idea of breathing, as we quoted here, really from the Tanya, it's brought from many of the Chaim Volozhiner, that when you breathe from inside of you. It implies a very close connection to God. And of course, you know, there's the ata osid lit limimene, you're going to take it away from me. There's a time of death. And it's interesting, we start every day, this is a fascinating thing, speaking about death. You know, and here I quote here from here on page 4. It says, in Ovis, in the end of the second chapter, Rabbi Tarfon said, Hayoyim kotzer v'amalocha meruba, the day is short, the task is great. The workmen are lazy, but the pay is outstanding. The master of the house is insistent. We wake every morning, we're not going to live forever, and there's much to do. And then it continues on about us. Says, at the end of the days, there's going to be a tchias hamesim. Says that we are going to come back to, we're going to rejoin. Says that spirit, that everything is going to be rejoined back into the body. The function of tchias hamesim, there's a whole question. According to the Mukubolim, when the Kabbalists, it is. During the period of the Messianic era for tzaddikim, there'll be tchias hamesim, and it will be life. Will be during this Messianic era in the time of Mashiach, like Gan Eden was, you know, in the Garden of Eden, the time of Adam Arishan, because it will be an idyllic time. It'll be a time that we will all be prophets. We will all have that spiritual sense. Our bodies will be transformed into something which is much more spiritual. And really, we're saying that this is, it's focusing, we're here for a short period of time. The purpose, why we're here, is the Gemara says, Hayoyim la'soysum u'mocher l'kabel scharam. Today, now is a time of activity. It says, at a later time, we'll receive the reward. And that's really, it's intimating, says, this idea of the reward. But it also has the notion, we go through a life cycle every day, in the sense we wake up like we're born, and we go to sleep, it's like death. And we quote here from page 5 that sleep is 1/60th of death, like it's a taste of death. But next morning we wake up again. And it's really this cycle is an affirmation to the ultimate cycle, you know, of death and rebirth. And really, all of this is implied, you know, really all of this is implied in these, you know, in these first words, you know, of the, and when we wake up in the morning. You know, we say, it says, Riboyin kol olomim, Adon kol neshamos, refer to God as, you know, as the master of the world, as the master of all the souls. We begin the day that God is in charge, and we have a mandate. And then we say, Baruch Atah Hashem, Amachzer Neshamos HaFagor HaMesim. We thank God that we've woken up in the morning. It's as if we were dead and we woke up. And it's a sign, as we said before, that's our fervent hope that it will, there'll be a reawakening for us personally, and the whole idea of Mashiach, the reawakening of the national, the destiny of the Jewish people. Now, are there any questions? Okay. I'll see you next week.
How do you reconcile the idea of good going? And the connection that people have two relatives in those accounts. It was just all shamas, and they weren't interconnected through family. I mean, this is just something that we have on our earth.
Yeah, you're asking two questions.
Yeah.
You're asking a question of how does reincarnation fit into this? Gulam fit into this? And how does the about the connection of family. In terms of Gilgulim, like Gilgulim really needs its own shiur, you know, its own lecture. But because there are three, according to the Kabbalah, according to the, you know, the Kabbalistic tradition, there clearly is this concept of Gilgul. And it has Gilgul reincarnation is, there are three, it's explained, there are three parts or functions or reasons why a person will come back to this world. One is as a punishment. Instead of going to Gehenna or whatever, person comes back as another person, as a non-Jew, as an animal. I mean, could come back and all. It's an act of to experience whatever he has to experience as well. There's another part of Gilgul that a person is given opportunity. You didn't fulfill enough mitzvahs, whatever it is. You're given an opportunity to come back. There's unfinished business. There's a beautiful pshat from the Vilna Gaon. It's available. It's in the Sefer Yonah. You know, there's a form that have, you know, from the Goin on Tanakh. It's on Yonah. So he explains the, and I'll be Kabbalah, but he explains a pasuk in the following manner. Let's say you have a person, it's the last day of his life, the last moments of his life. He's led an exemplary life. However, he's still missing something. If he finishes that something, he doesn't have to come back again. If he doesn't, he has to come back again. If he comes back again, he has a whole new life to lead. Who knows how many more mitzvahs he can do? How many more positive things he could do? On the other hand, we have free choice. You can make the wrong choices. So he explains the posuk in Yonah is touching upon this issue. And he explains with this a Gemara in Erev and Yud Gimel, but it's a very difficult Gemara. The Gemara says that for 2.5 years, that 3 years, is the Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel had a disagreement. Was it Toiv L'Odom Shenivra or Mishaloi Nivra? Is it better for a person been created or not created? It's a question of what it means. And finally, they came to the conclusion: better not to have been created. The Vilna Gaon in the Sefer Yonah wants to say the Gemara really is alluding, because it's an agadata, so it's not necessarily taken at face value. It's alluding to this question. Is it better for a person to come back a second time, or is it better to stop while he's ahead? And that's what they were they finally came better to stop while you're ahead. They also think of in gambling, it's good stuff. You know, is it stop while you're ahead? And he explains a pasuk based in Koheles, where he says the toivim hamesim, says asher mesu, better are the dead who died menachayim asher chayim adeno, who are still alive, the living that are still alive. So it's very redundant, the dead who have died, the living still alive. So the Goin explains is referring to Gilgul, to reincarnation. Better the dead who have stopped dying, who don't have to come back, than the living that are still alive. In other words, they're coming back a second time. And that was the conclusion of both schools, the Sham Beis Hillel. He said, "Achra Shenivra, but now that he's here, what should he do?" So that's his yafashpish b'maisav, mimashpish b'maisav. A person should have a firm grip of what his weaknesses are. What makes him tick? And if you see what your weaknesses are, that's what you came to be misakin to fix up. That's how we can take a look at it. This is the going in Yonah.
The whole concept that all the neshamas were by Matan Torah.
Yeah, so that's, first you have to know, assuming that the neshama is maybe choluk than ruach. I mean, you have to know.
The Bavitch says there's parts of us that keep on coming back. The neshama has lots of little pieces.
Right. Yeah, but there's different parts that need. In this form, speak about tikkunim. Right. Right. Yeah, there's parts that need tikkunim because we've damaged certain parts, whatever right. it is, through the thing. But al kaponim, so there's that notion of gilgul, of which is for tikkun. So one is punishment, one is for tikkun. The other is, they explain, that a person who's already made it, so to speak, and comes back here to be a mentor. You know, I guess a chosser would look like his rebbe, like, you know, and that, you know how the Tanya explains what tzaddik is. You know, the person really doesn't have a yetzirah anymore, doesn't have this struggle. I mean, they would explain, well, he's coming back. He's coming as a mentor, as a master, to inspire others. But al kaponim, the idea of Gilgal is very much part of this general thing. The Zohar says, when it occurs, and necessarily happens right after a person dies, there is an interesting Zohar of to bury the dead immediately, you know, don't leave it overnight to a... He says the Zohar explains the reason is, I mean, when it says it is one of the reasons, because if the person has to come back to this world and to be born, there may be a baby waiting for him right now, you know. So he has to come back right away.
Yeah, you know? But the
but that's the first question. But it seems it's well is part of the Kabbalistic tradition about Gilgulim. The Ramban alludes to it that that's the whole idea of Yibum. You know, is that the deceased brother really comes back as the reincarnation of the, you know, of that first child. Yeah. The other question you asked about family. It seems also this is not only it's from these, that itself, if only had it from all these people, that itself would be a source. But there's a Zohar, I think it's Parshas Noso, this is also about the idea that they're family. Evidently, there's something really important about family. You know, it's interesting, I don't know exactly what the guidelines are, but it speaks about the relatives come, there's an idea of family.
But is that just the Ruach viewing that and not the Neshama itself? Because
it seems to be
that's a direct contradiction to Gilgulim, because if somebody comes back as somebody else, so who's his mother? Who's his mother? Who's his father?
Yeah, well, there's what's interesting is about studies, and I find it in different literatures. They speak about Gilgulim, people come back together as families very often. Also, you know, there's a whole set of things that people are interrelated, and they come back together. You know, we. There's a lot of us and other people. We impact on them. This and it repeats itself. So it's very, I don't know, you know. But there are things. So it's, you know, when you're born into a family and this person is your father and this person is your mother, there's a reason. You know, I mean, we don't fathom, but there's a reason. Why is it? Sometimes roles change. In one life you're this, and the other, and then it changes. Someone to my chassid once told me that someone was saying the yortzeit for his father. Was the yortzeit his father? And he was saying Kaddish. And his little son was there. And the Rebbe saw this and was laughing. And they asked him, what is he laughing for? He said, to his side, you see that little kid? That's the father that he's saying Kaddish for. That's... You know, so it's I don't know, but it there's a tremendous body of evidence, non-Jewish sources, you know, but from researchers from across the world, which they've can't say it's not science in the sense it's not you can't reproduce this, but at least the methodology is the standard for scientific investigation.
There's a person right after Pesach. He had a heart attack. They took him to Oakwood Hospital, and I saw him every day for I don't know how many years. Avi Shapiro, now we went to see him also. But he was in a coma for 2 weeks, and when he finally came out of the coma, he got back his energy. He said he was with his parents, And his parents, it tells you about all the stuff he did with his parents. His parents died young when he was just a kid. But his parents, after they finished doing whatever they did with him, told him he has to go back. And he was in this coma for 2 weeks. And he remembers vividly, he'll even talk to you, Avi Shapiro, he'll tell you vividly everything that he saw and he did with his parents for 2 weeks.
Okay, fine.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that Gedolim among our people have accepted this, is it because it's Torah or because it's just it's universal science in some way?
What, the idea of the...
Well, he's talking about Gilgulim, the whole...
The reason that it's accepted is because of the Mekubalim, the Ramban and that whole school, and the Zohar. And they're... it seems to be a widespread that they believe it's authoritative. That's really why they're coming from. Is there not? Yeah. But it's not coming from any independent. But there is a tremendous body. It's a fascinating body of research which does support the idea of Gilgulim.